Welcome to the Fully Delighted Podcast, a hopeful and helpful resource from South Mountain Community Church, a multi-site church in Utah. Each week, we will be hearing from our staff as we explore what makes SMCC unique, as well as what it means to be fully devoted and fully delighted in Jesus Christ. We hope this podcast can be a helpful resource for you to take your next step with Jesus. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Fully Delighted Podcast. My name is Adam, and I get to serve as one of the executive pastors here at SMCC. And we are now going through, well, we've been going through our Contours series so far, which involves 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. And we're in kind of a unique spot now where we finished 1st John, which had 5 chapters in it. Now we're jumping over to some smaller parts. I mean, it's 2nd John is small.
And, yeah, less than 300 words. In the original Greek, and so we can cover it in one shot today and really walk away understanding an important letter.
Yeah, yeah. So we got Pastor Eric back. We got Pastor Trevor back. So it's kind of like we're kind of coming full circle as we end our podcast series.
We'll do 2nd John today. We'll do 3rd John next week, and we'll bring this season of the podcast on the Johannine letters to a close.
Awesome. Yeah, so I say we just get into it and go through what's here in the letter. So.
You know, on the way in, I was thinking, is there a better way to describe Johannine than that? Like the Johnny letters? Like there's Johannine, there's no other way to make that sound. Yeah. You get the Pauline epistles, Pauline. Someone needs to come up with like a
Johannine,
you know, a better way to describe the collection of letters by the Apostle John than Johannine.
That's true, because, I mean, he wrote a considerable amount.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, but he's got five pieces of literature in the New Testament. Yeah.
I think, you know, I was thinking, like, where did this come from? And I started to ponder, you know, sometimes when you take a person's last name and you turn that into something, it sounds more serious. But we don't know Paul's last name. And we don't know John's last
name. Or Zebedee. The Zebedean literature.
The sons of Zebedee,
yeah.
That's their dad's first name, though, right? You think that's his last name?
We could still go with it.
The Zebedean letters. Zebedean. Or you have, like, you know, Saul of Tarsus, you know, the Tarsiscan letters. You know, like, I don't know how. So you got to go with the first name. So I guess that's why. If a listener has a new theological, you know, word to describe these names, let us know.
Mm-hmm. I like Johannine.
It's all right. I guess it works.
I think one thing that is helpful is just teeing up sort of the difference between 1 John and 2 John.
Oh, that's good.
And, you know, our series has been called Contours, sort of the understanding being that, especially throughout 1 John, he's given these sketches, these outlines of sort of the most essential, most important ideas. And he's doing that because he's writing to a church that has been visited by these teachers who have really impacted them in a negative way with these ideas, with their teaching. So they're wavering, they're confused, they're uncertain. And in 1 John, he does a lot of theological work to kind of restore them, to do this. He's kind of cleaning up after the fact this mess that's resulted from these teachers visiting. 2 John is basically preventative medicine. He's writing to them, a different church, prior to the arrival of these teachers. They're still out visiting, making their rounds, and John knows they're going to show up on the doorstep at some point. And he's writing 2 John, so that way the same mess that occurred with the church in 1 John doesn't occur with this church.
Oh,
so he's telling them, this is how you handle it when they show up, so that I don't have to write 1 John again.
That's great. That's great. I appreciate that. Well, what part should we read through? I know we have not a ton of text to go through, so I kind of want to make sure we're doing it justice. I could go 1 through 3. I'm trying to think what's the best way to chop that up.
Yeah, let's do 1 through 3, and we'll just make some comments about the structure of first century letters and what is very standard in this and what is unique in this.
Great.
Intro.
Yeah. So we're in 2 John, and then verse 1 through 3. The elder, to the lady chosen by God, and to her children, whom I love in the truth, and not I only, but also all who know the truth, because of the truth which lives in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and from Jesus Christ, the Father's Son, will be with us in truth and love.
Yep. So if you compare this to one of Paul's letters, you see some standard protocol. You know, in English, we put the author of the letter at the end and the recipient at the beginning. But in a first century ancient letter, they had the author at the start, so you knew exactly who it was that was speaking, then the recipient, and then a prayer. So you have author, recipient, prayer. Mm-hmm. That is standard, and we see that here. But what's not standard and what's kind of confusing, and Trevor, you and I had a good discussion about this as we were preparing, is why these titles and what do they mean? So Trevor, you want to take us through that?
Yeah, totally. So the author is named as the elder. The recipient is the lady chosen by God and to her children. And so they're not first names. The question is, like, who's this actually referring to? And I think one of the things that we do see is that the elder, the author at very least, is on such close terms, such close relationship with this particular group of people, this church, that we know that he doesn't even feel the need to name himself. And so they'll just know who he is, which is interesting. When you read through the rest of the letter, I think you can see with so much of the language, the emphasis on truth and love, even at the very close of it, in verse 12, he says, so that our joy may be complete. You see language that is reminiscent, even like the same exact phrases that are, it's in 1 John mm-hmm. and then in John's gospel in this very same letter. And even tradition, kind of the earliest sources, they tell us that John is the author of this letter. So he seems to be the elder.
Yeah, and we could just circle or underline some of those similar phrases. I'm not giving you a new command. That's mm-hmm. That's in 1 John and the Gospel of John. You've had this from the beginning. John's always talking about the beginning in John right. 1 and in 1 John. Mm-hmm. Obey these commands. That's absolutely there. Obviously, walk in love. Antichrist, that aligns with what we see in 1 John. Continues in the teaching, continues in. That fits the language of John 15, abiding and remaining. And then, Trevor, you already mentioned it, joy. So you have all of these things that just really do align with John's perspective. The other thing that's interesting is I want to sit down someday with John, maybe over coffee, you know, in the kingdom to come, and just ask him I have a cough. I went running this morning. Why don't you like to use your first name? Because in the Gospel of John, he refers to himself as the one whom Jesus loved, and here he refers to himself as the elder. And so it's, you know, I don't think he's doing that because he finds himself so important. He's probably doing it because he's just saying, look, this is kind of just who I am, you know?
Yeah.
But that's an interesting take.
Yeah.
So content alone lets us know it's John's writing. Church fathers, early church leaders bring that conclusion too.
Yeah, sure. Totally. So then the second question is, who is the lady chosen by God and who are her children?
Yeah.
And there's a couple of different ways to take that. One is that it's a woman who's a significant leader in this church, and that John is in close relationship with her. Some have guessed that it could actually be, they're saying like Mary is one of the Marys from the New Testament.
Oh.
And so she's a significant leader in the church. The children are those who've come to faith within this particular ministry. That's one way of taking it. Another way of taking it is just looking at sort of the New Testament language that it often applies to the church or to individual churches, speaking of the church corporately as a woman or even as a bride.
That's what I wondered, yeah.
Yeah, and so the lady chosen by God would be referring to the church in its entirety, and her children, again, are those who came to faith within it. It's a little bit tricky because the first option, that it's a woman who's significant within the ministry, that seems to fit better with some of the language throughout the letter and how he continues to address her. First, and then to refer to her children. And it's a little bit awkward if it's just sort of symbolic. But then on the other hand, and when it gets to the end in verse 13, the children of your sister, who is chosen by God, send their greetings. He uses that same kind of language.
Yep.
And that one, that really seems to support the second view that mm-hmm. this is another church. So he's referring to two different churches that are right. in close relationship with each other with the same language here.
Like South Jordan and Draper, you know, they send each other their greetings, you know?
Yeah.
And so we worked on this principle. Not only did we want to share our conclusion to who the lady chosen by God is, but we also wanted to teach an interpretive principle along the way, which is we move from what is clear to what's less clear when it comes to reading the Bible. And sometimes when we read the Bible, we try to focus in on the unclear, and then we think about it harder and it gets even more unclear, and then we're stuck and we don't know how to move forward. But when we do what you just did, Trevor, which is look at the context as a whole, and you bring in that final statement of sister, that lets us know John's doing what the New Testament often does, because the local church is so precious, so valued, so so beautiful, it should be protected. Mm-hmm. It gets a feminine name at times, the Bride of Christ. And so sister language, lady language here seems to fit. Mm-hmm. Similarly to what you do with a boat. I always thought it was interesting that boats often have feminine names. And I think that has happened because sailors would have sort of a relationship with the boat in that way, you know, throughout history. And so they tend to name it that way.
It happens even. I've been getting a lot into different car subreddits. Somehow it came up in my discovery page, and like basically like people will be like, she looks great, you know, yeah. got the wrap on her, you know, but yeah. they do the same thing. Yeah, yeah. They just call it she, makes, you know, whatever.
Makes me want to name my cribbage board.
Yeah. Sure. If you want to do that, that sounds great, Trevor. You do that.
And then, excuse me, the other thing about children that I think is interesting is if you flip back into 1 John 5, John goes out of his way to say, everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. So trust in Jesus produces new life in so many ways, primarily the Holy Spirit dwelling in us, which gives us new perspective, new way to think, new value, new identity. And everyone who loves the Father loves his child as well. This is how we know that we love the children of God. So John's been talking about children a lot, and those are people who come to trust Jesus within the community of the local church through the ministry of this local community. Mm-hmm. And so when you put all that together, I'm persuaded to think that he's describing this community as a lady because they are the bride of Christ, so beautiful, so treasured, and the children of those who were born again through that ministry. And that's moving from what I think is most clear to what is less clear, and, mm-hmm. and that's the conclusion that I've come to. So that's the second piece.
Yeah.
And the third piece, I guess, the children.
Yeah, yeah. And I think what's especially important to take away from that is, at the very least, we know it's a church leader writing to a church community. Mm-hmm. He's not writing to just an individual Christian who's a part of a church, but he's addressing them on kind of outside of that context. It's written to a church community, and that becomes especially important as we get into kind of the heart of the letter.
Yeah, if you read it with your neighborhood in mind, in your single family home in mm-hmm. mind, it gets pretty confusing. If you read it as a church gathering, which of course in the first century and for many centuries meant in homes,
right. mm-hmm.
then you understand where he's going with this.
Yeah.
And that helps explain the big plot twist in the middle, which is a fantastic plot twist worthy of a, you know, an FX special. I mean, it's that Ooh. Type of plot twist.
Wow. Yeah, that's yeah. pretty. That's
what I said at Sojo is you get the sense that it's one of those thriller movies where the bad guys are on their way and the good guys are carrying with them information that the people need to know how to respond, and you don't know who's going to get there first.
Ooh,
and so
great.
It's like, dun, 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 and they're on their way. You know what I mean?
That is a
they're
great
they're racing, you know, to see who will arrive, because if the false teachers get there first, we're going to have a problem. But if the instruction gets there first and then John follows, you know, he's going to get there soon. He wants to be there face to face.
Yeah.
You see the thriller movie unfolding.
It would be funny if they got the letter like right after the people arrived and then they're like, we're going to have to ask you guys to leave.
Yeah, this could be a good little mini series.
Yeah, that's good.
That's you know
good.
What I mean? I can see this as a mini series.
Yeah.
I think The Chosen, we know when they're done with the Jesus, like Gospels, they should go to like the intense battles and dramas of the New Testament church.
I mean, yeah, there's plenty of drama going on.
So Chosen, if you're listening, come on, let's do it.
Yeah. All right, let's do verses 4-6. So it looks like it's probably that next section we should go through. It says, "It has given me great joy to find some of your children walking in the truth, just as the Father commanded us. And now, dear lady, I'm not writing you a new command, but one we have had from the beginning." There's that kind of repeat mm-hmm. terminology phrase there.
And let me just say this. One of the reasons he does this is not because he was running out of content and not because mm-hmm. this is a ripoff, plagiarized section of his first letter. Mm-hmm. It's because leaders are repeaters. He said the same thing over and over again. Mm-hmm. It was so important to him that they got love right.
Yep.
And one of the reasons he's stressing this is because he received this type of love from Jesus the day that Jesus washed his feet. So when you understand that John was radically transformed by the love of Jesus and the teaching of Jesus that accompanied the love, then of course John's saying this is the main thing. You know?
Yep.
So I just want to say that leaders are repeaters. When I'm getting tired of saying it, people are kind of starting to get it.
Yep.
And so if you're like, John, we get it already. It's like, but do we, you know? Do we love in that sacrificial, you know, wash the feet type of way?
I mean,
John was never going to leave that topic.
Yeah. So in verse 5, we pick up from there. "I ask that we love one another, and this is love, that we walk in obedience to his commands. As you have heard from the beginning, his command is that you walk in love." Man, that's all very similar to 1 John.
Yeah,
of course. And I think one of the things that I think we should do a little callback to is 1 John chapter 5, verse 4. "For everyone born of..." I read the wrong spot. Verse 3. "In fact, this is love for God, to keep his commands, and his commands are not burdensome."
Uh-huh.
His commands are not burdensome. And I always think it's important to understand what his commands are. They're in our best interest. They're not have-tos. They're get-tos. Our delight is on the other side. So, you know, when we got through this section on Sunday, we said let's just remind ourselves of something John has been saying all along. Christian maturity is marked by love.
Yeah.
The Gospel of John is all about that. First John is all about that. Second John is all about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If this is repeated this much, it's something to pay attention to.
Yeah.
It's not just, hey, I know, just go on. It's like, no, evidently, and I would say that, you know, human history shows that we do a lot of repeating of wrong things a lot of the time. So it's like, this need to be repeated then. Mm-hmm. I'd say it's likely it needs to be repeated now to the church. Yeah.
So I took a little detour in the message and I just said, you know, if you'd allow me to make this point, because I realize it's a bit of a unique point. I said, I think if John showed up at SMCC, he would like to call this place home. That he would say, you guys have got it. Mm. You guys are doing what I had in mind. And what I mean by that is that, first of all, devotion and delight together, mm-hmm. or commands and joy together.
Yes.
John was constantly preaching that. Yep. We measure maturity based on how well we love God and others. John would have loved that. Christian maturity marked by love. That's exactly what he's been talking about here. On top of that, he loves that there are partner churches, sister churches working uh-huh. together. He would have loved that we're multi-site. Yep. He talks about in the truth. So precise theology, antichrist, those who preach loose, false theology, right? Mm-hmm. He would have loved our commitment to helpful and hopeful teaching from the Bible mm-hmm. that's precise. I think when you put all that together, and also careful precision from the stage, from those who are in authority over the community as teachers, I think John would have just, you know, really enjoyed the ministry of South Mountain.
What do you think John would have thought about the value of maturity is measured by how well we love others and love
God? That's what I'm saying. He would have said, yeah, you guys got it. And of course, I made this point, like, we've built our church on the teachings of John and mm-hmm. Paul and, of course, mm-hmm. Jesus. Mm-hmm. They got their teachings from him. So we've just allowed the Bible to shape our ministry. Yep. But I think John would have, you know, walked in and just said, hey, can I call this place home? Mm. You know, I think he would have been, this might be a little bold. He would have been fully engaged here.
Language. Cool. I mean, some say he's still living, so who knows?
John, if you're listening, thank you for your letters.
Big question here, Eric. I'm curious, you know, from your perspective as a pastor, you know, we're looking at this now as a church. I mean, what do you think it means if you're, you know, if there's congregant people who attend SMCC and they're hearing this and they're hearing this repeated message of obedience and loving one another. I mean, what do you think that looks like practically in 2024 today? Like what would be some things if somebody's asking, yeah, I want to do that. What does that mean for me right now?
Yeah. Well, we talked about that a little bit in the message. It can mean a lot of things, but a lot of things that are countercultural. I mean, mm-hmm. discipleship to King Jesus looks pretty countercultural because I would just say this, everybody's a disciple of somebody. And in this day and age, this modern age, there's some things that you know, when we think of commands, you know, it's easy to think, you know, I don't cuss, I don't drink too much, I'm not sleeping around, like, mm-hmm. it's the no commands. And there, you know, sins of saying no to the sins of commission, you know what I mean? And that's very true. There's that's important. Sort of the things that are absent from our lives. But really, those things are only there as because there's something better that we're saying yes to. And so saying yes and no is really important. Disciples say yes to some things and say no to other things. And so when it comes to commands mm-hmm. that are in our best interests, those are things like love. I talked about this on Sunday, just am I growing in my capacity? So we talked about influence. Am I growing in my capacity to rest? I think for me, that's sort of countercultural. We live in a fast-paced society mm-hmm. where the more I produce, the more I'm worth.
Right.
So resting seems like an enemy to my worth. So why would I ever slow down for a day, shut mm-hmm. down the phone, not check the email, mm-hmm. and truly rest? Well, that is something that is an important part of following Jesus, you know? But to put it simply, you know, when it comes to commands, the command is love. And so the things that flow from love, well, those are the things that our steps of devotion. I don't know. I think at the end of the day, at the heart of sin, you know, it's us substituting ourselves for God. It's idolatry. You know what I mean? It's not mm-hmm. just bad behavior, but it's bad affections, bad gods in your life. You know what I mean? That lead to bad behavior. And so I think if you're listening to this and you're thinking, what does it look like to obey his commands? What does devotion look like? We've described devotion as authority, identity first, and then activity. Mm-hmm. And so if we're going to obey his commands, it starts with him as our authority, then us finding our identity from him, and then that flows into activity. So that's how I think of devotion, authority, identity, activity.
I love that. And I think that that description is very helpful because I think religion basically builds it the opposite way, right? Like, let's get your activity great and working as it should be, and then you'll figure out the rest as you go.
Right. And that's where John, I think, is doing the opposite. I mean, when he starts his gospel, John 1, and talks about Jesus as the organizing principle, the logos behind the universe, he is not beginning with activity. You know what I mean? So it's important. It's important that when we hear command, you know, that religious people, they jump straight to activity. I go to authority first, not activity next, identity next, and then activity. Because you can do the right thing for the wrong reason. For a religious motivation, trying to earn, and your life still looks like morality. So I want to make sure that we are inviting people to be changed from the inside out, to be motivated by what Jesus has done, and then allow their activity to flow from that.
Yeah.
And I think that is the type of love John's describing.
That's great.
Yeah.
I think that's a good thing to think through.
So here comes the plot twist.
All right. Here we go. This is where one episode ends. And you have to wait for next week's episode to come
out. Or remember back in the day when the season would end on a cliffhanger and you're like, I have to wait like 4, 5, 6 months?
I feel like that still happens. Oh, it's like years now.
Well, yeah, now I'm like, still waiting on Severance.
I'm waiting on Severance, Stranger Things. Anyways, that doesn't matter. all right, verses 7 through 11. I say this because many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh have gone out into the world.
So let's just pause right there. Coming in the flesh, there we see him just give us the clarity we need around the false teaching.
Right.
They were denying that Jesus was fully human. Denying his, and like we said last week, denying his humanity, denying his deity, you've lost Christianity. And so here he's inserting that. They were teaching this form of Gnosticism, this heresy around Jesus. Arianism, is that the actual heresy there, Trevor?
I mean, there's Gnosticism. Arianism doesn't come along until a little bit later on, but I guess you could say it's a precursor to it. Yeah,
right.
That is saying that Jesus is something lesser. But the particular form would be kind of Gnostic and creating a separation between Jesus, the human, and then Christ, the divine person, and saying that essentially they came together for a time, but then they split ways. And so essentially, John's saying that you're denying the incarnation. You're denying that Jesus is fully God, fully human. And when you deny that, you are the deceiver and the antichrist. You're distorting the clear understanding of who Jesus is. And when you distort that, you lose everything.
Yep. They've gone out into the world, meaning they're on their way. You know? They're roaming free.
So basically that end of verse 7, any such person is the deceiver and the antichrist. Watch out that you do not lose what we have worked for, but that you may be rewarded fully.
Yeah, this is an interesting section, you know, in English, fully. I like that word. It's in our mission statement twice. Trevor, what's the reward? What has John worked for here? I mean, is this a works-based righteousness type of situation that if I walk away, I've lost my salvation? What's going on?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And yeah, I think the way I would look at it, and I'm curious how you guys would kind of break this down, but I think it's kind of getting at the whole grace isn't opposed to effort, it's opposed to earning, and that John's saying that you've put forward a lot of effort in the way that you've lived, in the way that you've served Jesus, and in essence, what you can look forward to is the joy of seeing the fruit of that in this life and in the life to come. And it's not that you're, you know, not. I don't think it's so much about losing your salvation, because you can't work for that, you can't earn it in the first place.
Right.
But he's saying that I don't want you to lose the fullness of joy of seeing the fruit of what you have worked for.
Right.
Yeah. And I think at a practical level, you know, they've worked so hard to present the clear Jesus. And when you have the clear Jesus, you built a community of love and joy. And if you walk away from the clear teaching of who Jesus is, you lose that love and joy, and you lose the community we've worked so hard to build. So I think he's thinking of the culture too inside of this local church. You know what I mean? Like at SMCC or any local church, when heresy sneaks in, and it does, you know, good churches are polluted by bad teaching, and good people's lives are harmed by bad teaching. And what happens is you start to lose that joy that others have in love that others have worked so hard to build, because typically bad teaching brings in a sense of duty. Now I have to do this, and God's going to do this for me.
Transactional.
So love and joy goes away because I'm entitled. And like I could imagine, you know, Paul Robey saying, who was in, you know, the fifth row this weekend, if we were to do that, by the way, we never will, but if we were to do that, he would say, I've worked so hard to build a place of devotion and delight.
Mm-hmm.
And by preaching what was just said, if that were to happen, hypothetically,
yep.
We are losing what we've worked so hard to build.
That's a good, yeah.
I think that's kind of what he's discussing here.
Yeah. That's great. Let's continue on in verse 9. Anyone who runs ahead and does not continue in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Whoever continues in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not take them into your house or welcome them. Anyone who welcomes them shares in their wicked work.
Ooh, I don't want to share in anybody's wicked work.
No.
I don't want that to be true.
Yeah. So is this saying if two nice young gentlemen show up at your doorstep, want to come inside and have a spiritual conversation, that you should slam the door in their face?
That's a great question.
The answer is no, but it could sound like that.
Yeah. Well, unpack that a little bit for us. Yeah,
yeah, I think the thing that we discussed at the beginning is important here. Into your house. Do not take them into your house. Couple things going on. Once again, these are house churches, and this is written to a community. So he's not talking about a single family home and one door that opens to four. He's talking about a community that would open the door or offer the mic to somebody that would teach as an authority. Because that often would happen. You'd have traveling groups of teachers who were eloquent and compelling. When they showed up, people would say, take the mic. We want to hear from you, rabbi. We want to hear from you, great orator. And the orator would expect a good meal and a warm bed and a paycheck probably.
Yeah.
And that was very common. So he's saying, shut the door in their face, implying don't let them into your gathering because it's gonna harm people. I don't think John is saying don't process ideas around a table that are different than the ideas you have. I think he would absolutely be a fan of that. So I wanted to make that case. So really, we have to consider this as who's teaching on the stage at church, you know? Or if you are a house church, fantastic. Then don't open that singular door to your community.
Yeah.
But a dinner meal, cookies, dessert, coffee, tea, all that, a breakfast, all that is very different than a church setting where someone is teaching as an authority over the community.
Yeah, so tying back to who's the lady in this, you know, it's kind of like, hey, you got to protect who has influence over here. It's not, you have two nice-dressed young men come to my door and say, hey, we want to talk about, you know, this or that. That's not the same thing as inviting those same two people to say, you want to have some time on the mic on Sunday morning? Like, you want to teach? Like, that's a that's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Yep, one we would never do, and the other I would encourage people to do.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, at SMCC, we take John seriously here. We sometimes script the prayers on stage because prayers teach, and we want to make sure what's being taught is clear.
Yeah.
That's not to manipulate anybody or to not be authentic. It's because we want to be so authentic and true to the text that we do that. The songs that we sing, we don't just sing what sounds good or what's on the radio and what's popular or what other churches sing. We want to sing songs that teach good theology. Same with our sermons and on and on and on. We could go through our ministry because we take John seriously here. Trevor, do you think John is mocking them using a little sarcasm in the run ahead section?
Yeah, 100%.
I think this is interesting. Take us through that.
Yeah, I think in some ways, I mean, they're bringing about basically innovations in theology, right?
And
so they're saying, especially with the Gnostic stuff that we saw within 1 John, with the understanding that these are likely the same teachers going around, what they were essentially saying, they're probably calling John a dinosaur.
Yeah.
Like, you need to get with the times. You got to stop clinging to that old stuff. You need to like get up to speed, essentially.
Got it.
And John is mocking them by saying, when you run ahead, you've lost everything.
You're faster than Jesus.
Yeah.
Hey, is that what you want? You know, is that what you want?
That's good.
You've run away from him and I think you said run off a cliff or something. You know what I mean? You're going to go with them.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Don't run off the cliff with them.
Yep. To run ahead of Jesus is to run off the cliff. That's what they've done. Don't join them.
I mean, isn't that interesting, though, how like that does happen? It happened some 100-odd years or so after Christ and the beginning of the church. Mm-hmm. And then it still happens today. Mm-hmm. Like there's people who are like, that's so antiquated, dinosaur teaching, you know, and how do we look at it in view of, you know, to, you know, like 2,000 years later, that's still.
Yeah, totally. I remember The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. He had a couple of theologians in there and one who kind of came to faith later on in life and the other guy who didn't. And they're like theologians working in, you know, biblical theology. But essentially, the one guy is trying to plead with the other one. And what they discuss is how early on in their career, they began to write papers that they knew were presenting theological innovations that were straying away from orthodoxy, away from the clear and consistent teaching of the biblical writings. And they were doing so because they knew they would attract attention and they would kind of spur on their reputation within academic circles. It would build a career for them. And the one continued to do that and was at a point where it was an idol in his life. As he basically, as he gained attention for being theologically obscure, I guess you could say, that made him feel good about him. And that was the God in his life. And he wasn't willing to relinquish it, where the other guy realized, man, what we did was wrong. And when I die to that and I just place my trust in Jesus, I find so much more joy, so much more life, so much more love. And would you just let go of this and join me? And, you know, it's just a novel. But I think it really gets at a lot of the heart dynamics around this.
That's good.
Yeah. Yep. And so we want to just stick with the Bible in the church. I mean, sometimes false teachers lose their way. Sometimes church collectively can lose their way. And so instead of trying to let culture tell us the way, we go back to the Bible. And that's really important. So
great.
Then you have the final wrap-up.
Yeah. So just two verses at the end here. So 13 verses in this whole book. I have much to write to you, but I do not want to use paper and ink. Instead, I hope to visit you and talk with you face to face so that our joy may be complete. The children of your sister, who is chosen by God, send their greetings.
I almost wonder if he wanted to, he's like sending this so they don't get impacted by the teachers. But then in coming to them, if what he actually did was sat down and walked through 1 John with them.
Maybe.
Yeah, that would be great. I could see that.
Like I wrote this already. It still applies.
Yeah. So. Yeah, let me dust this off for you.
I
could see that. I did not thought about that, Trevor, but that would make sense. Yeah, and some things are worth talking about face-to-face, and obviously 1 John, if he was going to walk him through it, would be one of those things. you know, one of the things that's really important to SMCC is precision around soteriology, which is a fancy word for salvation. And in the category of soteriology, the debate that rages on is the debate between sort of free will and sovereignty, Calvinism, Arminianism, which those two titles are a little murky. So sovereignty and free will, what choice do I have in choosing Jesus? And so here you have these phrases, chosen by God, used a couple times. And I think for a lot of people in the Calvinist camp, they hear chosen by God and think individuals. But if we see Lady here as a collective community, and we think about Israel as a collective community, we see God choosing communities to be the light of the world. And this actually is helpful. So this is this is an important book, I think, in terms of the context of community, not an individual lady chosen. Because it's the community where God elects a community for the sake of the world, which is what John has in mind for how the church should function. And so I think that's another rabbit trail, but just at a simple level, I think this supports not a deterministic soteriology.
Totally.
I love it. Yeah. That's great. That's great. Very cool.
I know one other thing we talked about in the message was 7 ways to spot bad teaching. That was kind of fun to work through.
Yeah.
Do we want to run through
Let's hit it.
Let's wrap it with that. Yeah.
Read it for us, Trevor. Do you have it?
Yep. So number one, teaching that puts you at the center, teaching that glorifies you rather than God, because essentially it's teaching you to occupy a position in reality that is not yours. And anytime we live out of alignment with reality, we suffer the consequences for that. Number two, teaching that overpromises for God. It's possible to make promises to others on behalf of God that God has never made. And that's a recipe for disaster because you're trusting God to come through in a way that he's never said that he will.
Quick offshoot on that. Would you say that's taking the Lord's name in vain? Making promises for God on something that he hasn't promised to them?
I don't know. Well, I've never heard of
actually what I think is a little bit more accurate.
Yeah.
But that's another rabbit trail we don't need to go down.
That is a rabbit trail. Yeah. We'll talk about that later.
Sure.
Number three, teaching that minimizes Jesus. This is fascinating. I think so often when you find yourself in like religious communities that would fall outside of sort of the realm of orthodoxy, you find that Jesus is kind of like a rubber stamp, but more and more the conversation has so little to do with Jesus. It has to do with some other figure or techniques or the amount of your faith, and that all of that becomes what's center. And Jesus is sort of a label that you attach to it, like a nice sticker, but he's not the core of it. Yeah. Number four, teaching that produces transactional faith. You do for God, so God will do for you. Or if you don't do for God, then God's going to get you, right? Mm. That's religion. Mm-hmm. That's not the gospel.
Yep.
Number five, teaching that limits your responsibility. This one, you could actually go pretty deep philosophically, kind of to what you were just talking about with determinism. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the reality is we live in a world where we do carry certain responsibilities. And any teaching that teaches you otherwise, that would lead you to live otherwise, is setting you up for failure. Mm-hmm. Number six, teaching that leaves you waiting on your miracle or blessing. And that's not to say that God doesn't do miracles, can't do miracles. God can do whatever he wants to. But there is some teaching that will say, you know, your plan A is God's miracle, God's blessing that's coming for you, and you don't even need a plan B. Mm-hmm. And that rarely works out well.
No.
And then number seven, teaching that utilizes shame and guilt to motivate you, that manipulates your emotions in order to get you to do what they want you to do. And primarily it's in the favor of those who are doing the teaching / manipulating.
Yeah, the privilege and benefit goes to the people doing the teaching.
Yep.
This is important because John in 2 John wants the community to be able to spot false teaching, which for them is teaching that minimizes Jesus, saying he just came in the flesh. You know, so that's really present in the letter, I think, is that false teaching. But today, these false teachings, I mean, they're everywhere. Mm-hmm. They're on Instagram. They're getting shared. Yep. They are getting liked. There are these sermon jam clips of people saying things like this, and they look good and they look eloquent. And I just wonder if John would say, okay, shut the door, meaning don't let them in their home. In your home means unfollow them on Instagram. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Do not let them into your life as an authority, because to the degree that which you do, if their teaching is harmful, it will harm you.
Yep.
And so we could put names to these. We have in the past. I don't know that we want to do that today. John has no problem in 3 John putting a name to someone who is harming people's faith.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Diotrephes. Which even sounds like a bad disease, you know? So in English, at least.
Diotrephes, what a disease.
I know, yeah. The disease of Diotrephes. But, you know, you don't have to look far to find people that are teaching these things. And rather than give names, I would prefer our people to know how to spot the teaching with names that they've never heard of, or you move to a new city, you know how to spot it when you show up at a new church, you know?
Yep.
And sometimes this just lives in evangelicalism. And so when people come here and begin to speak at SMCC, we got to show them these things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because it's very sneaky.
And I would say that what you're describing is, let's teach people how to think, not what to think.
Yeah.
You know, here's how you could spot in any of these. We don't need to put a name necessarily to it.
Right.
But here's how you can filter things and look at them.
Yep.
So.
Mm-hmm. Well, there we have it. That's 2 John.
Great. Well, thank you guys. We got one more week of this next week. And then we got Good Friday. We got Easter and all that good stuff coming along. So, excited for this season. And it's been good over these weeks with this podcast.
Yeah, it's been fun.
We will see you all very soon.
Yeah, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Thanks again for joining us for the Fully Delighted podcast. If you enjoyed this hopeful and helpful resource, we'd love to have you leave us a review or share an episode with a friend. For more information about SMCC, please visit us at our website at smccutah.org. Thank you for trusting us with your time, and we look forward to having you back again soon.